D-Box Radio.
Hi, I am Abba Carmichael, subbing in this week for show host Maxine Margot Rubin, and this is the Many Shades of Green, our program that explores environmental and social issues that reflect the greening of our communities. The Many Shades of Green delves into topics that affect the environment both locally and globally as we move to raise social awareness via culture and politics, music and the arts. There are many variations or shades of environmental consciousness which affect what actions we take to protect the planet. Everyone has a shade of green that connects them to the natural earth. Our guest this week on the Many Shades of Green is Tony Cerna, co-founder and development coordinator for Dancing Rabbit Eco Village, a model community which encourages its members to live sustainably with the ideology that resources should be consumed, that should not be consumed faster than their natural replenishment. Tony attended Stanford University and designed and installed the Dancing Rabbit Renewable Microgrid. It's time to take matters of the environment into our own hands, and individual conservation is the place to start. So, Tony, welcome to the Many Shades of Green. It's so great to have you here.
Thanks, Alba. It's great to be here.
What was your green light bulb moment? What was it that caused you to want to be in the green movement?
For me, that moment was when I was in college. I was, I was a student at Stanford, cared more about playing Frisbee and seeing concerts than really anything else. And then I ended up one day heading to a concert in San Francisco and didn't realize it, but I was headed into the middle of a riot. It was the day of the verdict for the Rodney King trial. And San Francisco was, you know, lit up. There was, fires on Market Street and the police were there. And I walked right into that off the bus and was sort of stuck there in the city suddenly. I mean, the concert was still going on, but I had no way to get home. They had shut down all the public transit. And it was at that moment that I realized how much the world needed changing. And so it was then that I became an activist, and it was shortly after that I focused on environmentalism as that focus. But it was really that experience of that Rodney King riot that really radicalized me.
Wow, so you just kind of had a snap.
Yeah, I grew up in the suburbs. I was a pretty normal kid. I mean, I had some inklings towards the counterculture, and so was already into alternatives, but I hadn't really decided to be an activist at that point.
Okay.
And so this was the moment when I took my, you know, desire to live alternatively and turned that into a desire to make social change.
Wonderful. And how did that start? Was it just immediately, okay, social change, I'm going to start an eco village? Or are there other climate change issues that you felt needed addressing and that it kind of morphed into that?
Well, this was the early 90s, and a lot of the activism at the time were like sitting in trees in the redwood forest to prevent them from getting cut down, and there was a lot of protests and, you know, political action. And, you know, I was aware of that. It was all around me. I had a lot of friends who were activists, either in like homelessness activism or environmental activism. And I looked at that, I tried that, and I realized that like protest activism wasn't really the thing for me. I really felt like I wanted to be working for something positive. And so some friends and I came together around this idea of creating a positive alternative for, you know, sustainable living rather than just going out and fighting against the bad things that we saw happening.
Wonderful. And with that, what were some of the things that you were hoping to accomplish?
Well, we were trying to, you know, change the world. And so we were trying to, you know, create a model for sustainable living. And, you know, we were looking at the, you know, the horrors of, you know, environmental, you know, state of things at the time. And a lot of that was, I mean, we're just getting the beginnings of climate change knowledge at that time. It wasn't nearly so well understood and well known, and the models weren't really put together yet. But there was already an environmental movement because of the habitat destruction and the species extinction and the poisoning of our planet and the poisoning of our communities. And our personal health. And so we were already focused on that and saw that there was a need for a change. And really, climate change has become, you know, sort of our rallying thing, because it's taken what was an urgent issue and made it just like a fantastically urgent issue, you know, the need for sustainability.
What is an eco-village?
That's a good question. At the time, we didn't have that term yet. It was a new concept, and we described ourselves as creating an eco-town. Eco-villages are now happening all over the world, and to me, they're really any place that people gather together in a specific location to try and live more sustainably. And so it's, you know, like your show, The Many Shades of Green, that can happen in many different ways. It can be urban, it can be rural, suburban, it can be at varying degrees of greenness. But it's that effort to, you know, take a neighborhood or a small community or a rural area or, you know, a group of people, you know, larger than a household but smaller than a city, and turn it into a village that is focused on sustainable living.
So your eco village is named Dancing Rabbit. That seems to have like a Native American vibe to it. How did that name come about?
There's a good story to that. It was 1993, and it was at Earth Day, and it was our first public presentation, and we needed a name. You couldn't have a table without having some sort of name and a little poster and some flyers to hand out. And so we didn't want to have a name like the Institute for Sustainable Living. We didn't really want to live in an institute. No one really wants to live in an institute. And so someone was reading a book and saw the phrase Dancing Rabbit Creek, and it was a reference to a place in Mississippi where the Choctaw Indians signed a treaty with the United States. It was a very tragic event, really. But they really liked the way that Dancing Rabbit just flowed, and we became the Dancing Rabbit Project, and we assured ourselves that it was a temporary name. We would change it as soon as we had a chance, and it was just for now, and now it's 20 years later, and we're still using that name and very proud of it at this time.
Awesome. That's wonderful. So you just mentioned 20 years. Can you give a little bit of background on how you guys, from where you started to kind of where you are now?
Sure. The first 2 years, a lot of us were still in school, and so it was a lot of reading and research and just figuring out what we were doing. We had an email list. We had potlucks once a month. We were gathering our energy and our ideas. And then it was in 95 when a group of us actually moved in together into a house, and we said, we're going to do this. We're actually, you know, not just going to have this idea and talk about it. We're actually going to make it happen. And so we were living in Berkeley. We spent about a year there living in a house together and formulating this idea before we basically all got in a van and drove across country to Missouri, where we ended up finding land. And it was in 96 that we moved to Missouri, and in 97 we bought land. And there were six of us in the founding group who moved to Missouri. And we've now got 75 people living in our community and have built 30 homes in that village, all out of natural materials. And, you know, we're really trying to make it happen.
You attended Stanford University, mm-hmm. and you grew up in Detroit, mm-hmm. correct? How do you have any thoughts of, you know, of how this might be able to influence your hometown? I mean, Detroit has a lot going on.
Detroit does have a lot going on and a lot of need right now. And I've actually got some friends, people who used to live at Dancing Rabbit, who have now moved to Detroit and are activists there working on sustainability issues. And so I go there pretty frequently to connect with them and to connect with the movement in Detroit, because it's really a fascinating possible future for Detroit. They have 40 acres of open space where they are looking towards the future, where they could be the only city in the world that grows all of their food from within their city limits.
Really?
Yeah, they have enough space for that. And when I was there last, I was giving a talk, and one of their city council people was in the audience, and one of her tasks at hand right now is coming up with an agriculture policy for the city of Detroit, because, you know, people have a few chickens, people have little gardens, but they're talking agriculture, like, and how does that work within a city limits, and what are the policies for that, and how do they make that happen, and how do they turn those vacant lots into places where that can be productive for food and fuel?
How does one go about starting an eco village? You mentioned, like, you jumped into a home with some of your friends, mm-hmm. and you said, okay, we're going to start this. And then you said, okay, let's get a car. Let's drive across. I mean,
I skipped a few steps in there, didn't I?
How do you get the land? I'm literally from step one, like, how did this turn into something sustainable?
Sure. the first step is really connecting with the movement that's already out there. We were very lucky to connect with an organization called the Fellowship for Intentional Community, and they have a very vibrant website at ic.org, and they list thousands of communities around the world and around the country. And we tapped into that. We visited a number of communities, and we learned from people who had already gone before us. So, you know, the 60s communes that were still around, we visited those, we learned about them, we understood how they worked, and we learned from their both successes and failures. Then we, you know, put together a core group that had the passion and the desire to do it, and began learning some of the skills that we would need. And that ranged from, you know, gardening and building, but also to accounting and legal structures, and, you know, how are we going to make that all come together. And then the hardest part really for a founding group is really making the plunge and just doing it, because you've got to get out of your normal day-to-day lives and all do that at the same time to move together to make this reality, you know, come true. And so we were lucky that we were young and, you know, impatient and, you know, intrepid at that point. And so we went out to do it. And we were able to borrow money from friends and family and from organizations that supported community. And we were able to find land that we could afford. And we bought 280 acres, you know, outright. And there we had it.
Wow. And what are the type of people that come there? Who was it that you pulled from? Who, you know, what was your pitch of, hey, why don't you come live on our new eco-village?
We get people who are looking for some alternative. I mean, people are, you know, desperate to find a positive way to live. And that can be a different sense of community in a lot of cases, or a different desire to live without harming the earth, or just in a really positive way to regenerate the earth. And so we get people from all over the country, you know, from the Midwest, from the coast, looking to find that alternative and find some way that they can put their passion into reality and, you know, contribute to really greening the world rather than, you know, adding to the destruction.
And is there kind of a wide, you know, variety of the types of people that you get? I know you're saying from all over the country, mm-hmm. but educational backgrounds, like, are a lot of them, you know, sustainable backgrounds, or do they all come with a love of sustainability, or is some of it almost like does anybody come with like a rehab type mentality, mm-hmm. where they're coming to get away from everything else they know, and this happens to be a really great opportunity for that?
We have people from a lot of different backgrounds. I mean, educational diversity and economic diversity. We don't have as much ethnic or racial diversity. Some of that's just by being in a rural area in the Midwest. Some of it's true of the green movement in general. And we struggle with that. We're trying to change that, but it's a hard thing to change in our environment. And people come for a variety of reasons. There are certainly people who start with a notion of, like, I just, you know, don't, the mainstream society doesn't work for me. I need to find something different. And some people who come from a place of, like, yeah, this totally works for me, but this is just not right. I can't live this way. This is not a good thing for the world, and it's not good for me. And so they are looking to do something really different. And sometimes that's a passion for having a great place for your children to grow up. Sometimes it's about really wanting to be able to build your own home or grow your own food. It really depends. Each individual brings their own piece.
Very cool. So I guess I think in almost a very communal type society, but I guess the kids that are raised there, they go to school like other kids, because you're still in districts. It's not like, you know, religious or anything like that. You guys are living normal society lives. You're just not having the same environmental impact as everybody else in society.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's very similar to, you know, middle America, in the sense of, you know, we all have our own homes, we have our own jobs and our own income. We, you know, live our lives, you know, much the same way that many people do. But we do have a much greater sense of cooperation with our neighbors and connection with our neighbors. And just generally an experimental attitude towards social things as well as environmental things. So there's a lot of homeschooling. There's some kids who go to the public school. There are, you know, kids who go off to college at 16 or go off to boarding school because they're looking for some really exciting alternative. A lot of people sending their kids to really interesting camps, primitive skills, you know, that type of thing. So it's a real experiment, and people come looking for those alternatives.
That's so awesome. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the details of Dancing Rabbit and just living in a green community. Be right back on the Many Shades of Green.
Hi, this is Tilkson Ghost Horse, and you're listening to Many Shades of Green on BeeBoxRadio.com.
And we're back on the Many Shades of Green. My name is Abba Carmichael, and I'm subbing in today for Maxine Margot Rubin. And today we're here with Tony Cerna. He's co-founder of Dancing Rabbit, which is an eco-village in Rutledge, Missouri. So we've been talking about what an eco-village is and how you got to start one, and then what that process was. Now I want to go into what Dancing Rabbit does for the community. So how does Dancing Rabbit serve the green movement?
It is interesting and difficult sometimes, is being in a rural area where we are, to really have the impact that we'd like. But the thing that we see ourselves as providing is a positive example and a reality where we can say, when people want to cut their emissions by 90%, we're already doing that. We're proving that it can be done and that it's that you can live an abundant lifestyle and cut your emissions at that level and reduce your impact in that way. We're sort of pushing the envelope on what it means to be green and what sustainable living means, especially in a time when, you know, everyone is using the term sustainable to mean almost anything. Yeah. And we're also training people to be activists in the green movement and giving them that profound experience where they come to us for a week or a day or a summer and they have an amazing experience and they take that back to their communities and create change there.
That's fantastic. That was actually something I wanted to ask you about. Is that an option? Because for a lot of people, the idea of just picking up, like myself even, like I can't imagine leaving New York City. Like, I'm in love with this place. But the opportunity to go and see what you guys are doing in action and then be able to bring as much of that back to my personal life and to my community would be awesome. So that's an amazing opportunity. And how many people do you tend to have who come? Are those like summer, almost like a summer camp type of thing? Or what do you find?
There's a variety of options for coming to Dancing Rabbit and getting to experience firsthand what our eco-village is like. People come for just an afternoon tour if they're close enough, you know, if they're in St. Louis or Kansas City and can come just for a few hours. People come for our visitor periods, which are 1 week to 3 week sessions. They come for summer internships, which are often 1 to 6 months long, where they might be learning natural building or gardening or some specific skill while they're there. We also have an eco-village education course that's a 5 week course during the middle of the summer, and then a variety of other workshops as well. So, I mean, during a year, we might have hundreds of people come through our village to learn and experience firsthand what eco-village means.
And what is something like coming to your community and living there for a week or 3 weeks cost? Like, what is the trade for that?
We try to make it as accessible as possible. It does end up costing a few hundred dollars. I forget, it's a sliding scale, so it really depends on your income level. We try to make it accessible to anyone. We don't turn anyone away for lack of funds, but we try to make it something where people are, you know, giving a little bit to us just to make sure that that covers their room and board and the people who are taking their time to provide that education and to support our nonprofit that's doing that work.
Sure, sure. So how does Dancing Rabbit compare with other eco-villages that are out there? You mentioned IC.org and its long list of all the eco-villages that exist. Mm-hmm. What are there different types of eco-villages across the states? Like in Missouri, are you guys a certain type of eco-village, and closer to LA is a different type of eco-village? Are there regional differences?
There is. I mean, each eco-village has to fit within its environment. I mean, that's the nature of, you know, fitting into your ecology. So it depends on what bioregion you're in, whether you're suburban or urban. There's great eco-villages across the country. There's one right in downtown Los Angeles. There's a great one in North Carolina. There's ones in western Massachusetts. There's one in upstate New York. Eco-Village at Ithaca is a leader in the movement. Dancing Rabbit is sometimes described as like an orthodox eco-village in the sense that we're like really taking both the term village and the term, sustainability very seriously. We're hoping to grow to a village of 500 to 1,000 people and really have a pretty strong definition of what sustainability means. And so, the former editor of Communities Magazine described us as the most rigorous eco-village in the nation. And so we try to set the tone for it being a real, you know, demonstration of what sustainable living can be.
And I know I asked how do you get people, but is there any kind of recruiting that you guys do? Do you push out, or is it, you know, is there marketing basically for you guys?
I mean, we have a very active website. We're on Facebook, we're on
sure.
the internet.
I mean, New York City markets, you know, they're marketing themselves. No,
sure.
No different.
I mean, you know, part of why I'm here in New York City is recruitment and outreach and both changing the world through teaching people about the green movement as well as hoping to turn them on and have them come to Dancing Rabbit. Last time I was here in the city, I gave a few talks, and out of that we've gotten two visitors who came for the summer this year.
Nice. Very nice. Well, welcome to New York. I hope that it's successful this time as
Thanks.
Well. So your buildings, my understanding is you have 30 homes.
Mm-hmm.
With 75 people.
That's correct.
Okay, so several families.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all made out of natural materials? You all built them yourselves?
Almost everything was built by us, and we practice a lot of different natural building techniques, so a lot of building with straw and clay. So we have straw bale buildings, we have cob, we have sort of adobe-type structures, earth bags, waddle and daub and light clay straw. There's all these different techniques that we've been experimenting with there. We also have a number of green buildings. So not everything is quote unquote natural building, but a lot of it, you know, reclaimed lumber, reclaimed timber, you know, minimizing the impact both in the building process as well as in the life cycle of the building, trying to, you know, super insulate, make them very efficient, passive solar design so that, you know, all of our houses are, you know, gentle on the environment as the people are using them.
And you have a new community center being built.
We're working right now to build a new community center. It will be the sort of heart of our village and also a flagship in the sustainable building movement. We're hoping to be certified LEED Platinum, which is the highest standard in LEED, and also by the Living Building Challenge, which is an even more stringent requirement certification system. And, you know, we're really trying to put ourselves on the map in the green building world and really reaching out to people in the, you know, in those communities and in the passive house movement to try to connect with those so that we can be influencing those movements as they are influencing us.
From what I know, getting LEED certification and those different certifications, those costs, those are costs on top of the building materials. How much does something like a new community center or a new home that you have to build, what cost range is that for you
to,
all?
To get LEED certified?
To get LEED certified and just the building materials, you know, how much does an eco home cost?
Right. We try to make them very affordable, and one of the ways we do that is we do a lot of the work ourselves. So a lot of that LEED certification process, we're learning how to do that ourselves. We're getting support pro bono from people who believe in our work. And the average home at Dancing Rabbit, I mean, people have built homes where they have spent as little as $5,000 out of pocket to build themselves a space to live in, but that's putting in a lot of their own sweat equity and going out and salvaging materials and, you know, putting that together. If you value all of your labor, you can build something at $60 a square foot or even might go as high as $100 a square foot. And but when in the end you have a building that's much cheaper to operate because you've already provided for the heating and cooling and even the electrical systems, you know, and water, all of your utilities are sort of included in the construction of the building.
What does a home generally look like? I mean, is there, you know, you have, are you cooking in your living room, you know, or how does that work spatially? How big are they?
It really varies a lot. People have done a lot of different things, but we've ended up with a pattern where people build separate homes just for a bedroom and like a sitting area, and then often share other areas such as a kitchen or bathrooms in a common facility and maybe in a little cluster of homes would share one kitchen together, so there'd be 6 to 8 people who would cooperatively share that kitchen. In the end, we have about a third of the square footage that the average American has in residential square footage, but that's the same as was average in this country in 1950. So it's not really that we're going back and living in tiny little spaces. Sure. We're living just the way that our parents did when they were young. But the homes in this country have gotten bigger as the families have gotten smaller. And so almost every place besides New York, people are living in homes that are much bigger than, in my opinion, than they really need.
Yeah. And with a being with a third smaller, you have less than 10% of the electricity that's being used? Is that?
Yeah. One of our things that we've discovered is that, you know, it's great to look at alternatives. And so we use solar power and wind power. We run our vehicles on biodiesel and electricity. But the real thing that we've discovered is that the key to sustainability is actually reducing your use in the first place, you know, conserving and efficiency. And so our homes use less than 10% of the electricity that the average home might use. We drive our cars less than 10% of the miles that the average American might drive. We use less than 10% of the propane and less than 10% of the water in household use than the average American. And we do all that and still live what you would recognize as a middle class lifestyle.
And with water, you use only 10 gallons per person per day in your house compared with the roughly 135 plus gallons that the rest of us use. How?
What's the secret? Yeah. The main secret is that we use composting toilets, so they're dry toilets that you just don't use any water, and that's really accounts for a third of the water in your average household is for, you know, flushing fresh water down the toilet, basically. We also don't allow for any leaks. I mean, another third of the water that we use in this country is actually wasted in leaky faucets and leaky plumbing. And then the other third, we cut down by having low flow fixtures, just being very conscious of how we use our water, not doing a lot of irrigating of lawns. We're basically, you know, taking water and treating it as the precious resource that it is, and we still do use water to irrigate our gardens, but we're not using it just to grow a lawn that's not really being used for anything effective.
A word that I saw used is humanure.
That's right.
What can you go into detail on exactly how that comes to be?
Humanure.
I have a few ideas.
Humanure is like a specific process for doing composting toilets, and it's a way to, you know, have a dry toilet that you take the waste and you compost it until it, you know, and it sits in the compost bin for 2 years, and then from there it can be used to fertilize. We use it on fruit trees. It can be used in gardens safely, but we, you know, just for, you know, being
mentally
double safe, we keep it away from the, you know, right on the vegetables that we might eat. So we keep it on fruit trees and other plants like that.
That's amazing. And that's something, what type of foundations was it that Dancing Rabbit created versus things that have just been around for years and years or decades?
Foundations? I'm not...
Things like humanure, you know, like where did these concepts start? Like where did you pull all these ideas from?
Yeah,
and are there things that you feel like that you wish you could implement, but you haven't yet? Or
right. In a lot of ways, we haven't invented anything new, and there's nothing that we're doing that other people aren't doing somewhere else. We've just decided to put them all together in one place where you can see them firsthand, you know, all working together in the social structure that really makes those just feel really natural and, you know, flow with what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, we didn't invent solar energy or wind power or humanure or biodiesel or electric vehicles. We're just taking those and using them in one place. You know, we didn't invent community or cooperation either. Those are just
sure.
the secret to making all those things work for us.
Sure. And also, so you work from home and you mm-hmm. support yourselves on around $8,000 per person
mm-hmm.
on average. How do you guys just not buy things? You know, do you celebrate birthdays? Do you celebrate holidays?
We cut our expenses in a lot of different ways. Some of it is by doing more for ourselves. So we're growing some of our own food. We're building our own homes. We create a lot of our own entertainment. We do also just live in a more affordable place. You know, food is more affordable, you know, in Rutledge, Missouri than it is in New York City.
Sure.
So we save a lot of money in those ways. The biggest expenses we have are healthcare and travel, and those are really some of the biggest variables in people's lives. So I do think that we spend a lot less money on consumer goods, on fashion, on, you know, electronics, et cetera. But we also, as a community, people still have computers, they still have the internet, they have access to the world, they have access to both nature and the natural environment, as well as the social environment and the community that feeds them in a social way on a day-to-day basis.
Amazing. And the last thing that I want to ask you is, from your years living in Dancing Rabbit, what do you feel what is advice that you would want to pass on to people like me and our listeners, simple things that we could be doing that would make an impact?
I think the biggest thing that I'd like to share is that you can do it. You can change your own life to really be sustainable. And even more important, you can work with your neighbors and work in your community to transform your community as well. So don't stop just by changing your own light bulbs and changing your diet and changing the way that you live your life, but connect with your neighbors, figure out how to cooperate with them and help elevate the sustainability of, you know, your block, your neighborhood, your city, you know, by working with other people in your community.
It's beautiful. Community is key.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here, Tony. Really, really appreciate
it. Yes, thank you, Abba.
So we have been talking with Tony Cerna, co-founder of Dancing Rabbit, an eco-village that is self-sufficient and located in Rutledge, Missouri. His vision for ecological sustainability is practiced every day by members of the Dancing Rabbit eco-village community, where people live off the land and off-grid, and are always mindful of Mother Earth as they grow food, preserve the water, use alternative energy, and in all senses of the phrase, they become one with nature. So thank you so much for being here. And thanks for joining us on The Many Shades of Green, our program about environmental sustainability, culture, the arts, and community. Listen to the show on your laptop, tablet, desktop, or smartphone. Visit us on Facebook, send us a tweet at TM Shades of Green, and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. A big thank you to our sound engineer, Brian Horowitz. And again, I'm the show's co-producer, Ava Carmichael, subbing in for Maxine Margot Rubin. And we're just reminding you to pick your shade of green and raise your eco-consciousness. See you next time.
You're listening to BeBoxRadio.com.